We're on?
You're listening to.
Gotcha.
This week. So kick back and be amazed. Yeah. Take it away, guys.
Well, hello everyone. This is Jim Rizzoli here. My brother's not with us tonight, but we do have a special guest that we're going to be talking with, Diane King from Texas. Diane, you are on the line right now, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's good. So I guess it's just me and you and the world here. So last week, maybe you can just give us a little bit of background about you. Because, first of all, we were talking a little bit about Germany and the beginnings of the Third Reich. And we got to a certain point in it anyway from last week. The early years, anyway, and where we, I think we came up to the 30s, right? Is that where we were?
1933.
Okay. So anyway, but let's just give those out there if they're listening a little background about you and your interest in the topic matter, and maybe even tell us how you got interested in it too, and why you continue on to be interested in it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Politically incorrect. Okay, my life story, I suppose, is not, except that a rabidly fundamental, I suppose, a Christian person, mother of five, grandmother of seven, and in the mid-90s, before my access to the computer, it began to be clear to me that Germany was not getting a fair shake. Now, why would that matter to me? My family has told me that as long as they can remember, I've always had a love affair with Germany. It almost seemed bizarre to them, a kid being so involved. I thought, to the genre of the TV shows at the time. Even the most ridiculous cliche, Rat Patrol, Hogan's Heroes, but I watched them all. I watched all the movies. I read all the books. And it just was part of who I was. I actually joined the military because it was the closest thing I could come to the pageantry of what National Socialist Germany was. And while in the military, of course, I had become a believer, a saved person, in my high school senior year, so I joined the Air Force and began to learn how to study the Bible and so on. It wasn't until, like I said, I'd been married and I had four kids at the time that I realized that Germany, which I loved and had been suppressed for decades, it seemed, was something that was still present. Why were they given a bad shake? Why were they the only ones that were not allowed to have to trot out their, if you will, criminals like the Soviet Union was on May 1st, and all the rest of us on our national holidays? Only Germany was not allowed to. So I started looking into it. Magazine articles, the kind of books that came out, Hitler's Willing Executioners, which is an atrocity. It was also lie infested, and just numerous books and publications, and that was the. I went to Time Life for background about Germany. I wrote things. I wrote novels. I incorporated this thing into these novels, and it became clear to me that as the internet emerged and I did searches on German bashing, I came really close to finding what I really needed. But it wasn't until a friend invited me to explore what was available on the Zundel site that I find my home. I felt like I had arrived. And so when, in pursuing that, I found at least a dozen other sites that are now called revisionist sites that embodied and shared and were repositories for debunking what became the demonization of Germany. And there's one word for that, and that is the Holocaust. When I read, did 6 million really die, off of the IHR site, the Institute for Historical Review, and the 66 questions of the Holocaust, I was aghast. I mean, I knew there was some suspicion in regarding the JFK assassination, but when I realized that the biggest lie perpetuated on our society involved the Holocaust and the tentacles and the that it had in every area of our life, I mean, I was blown away. I was never the same again. It absolutely radically changed my life, and it will. That's why I think people don't want to know, because they know that the truth will change their life. And so this became just as an important part of me as sharing. It became, I embraced it as part of sharing the truth about Jesus Christ was also the truth about our history. And once you embrace the truth, you find that it begins to open up areas and ways you had never known. As it turned out, 9/11, again, the JFK assassination, the Sandy Hook thing. I mean, it just dominoed. But this was the most important thing. Why is the Holocaust issue the most important thing? And that's because it is the power by which we are enslaved, and it is, and to coin a phrase from a friend who shared this with me, it is the boot at our neck. Mm. And so it's important to deal with this issue, and the survivors, the German survivors, there are a number of them that are still alive, and their families that are suffering from this. And the draconian laws that have been put in place because of this. Yes, this is the issue. This is the main issue. How did it happen? And that's when you have to go back to the earlier years of Hitler, because the most demonized and the most lied about individual in history. Probably, yeah, I'd say that. And so to debunk that by looking at the information that might actually reveal the truth, again, you become a revolutionary. A lot of people close to you, people far away from you, look at you like you have absolutely leave of your senses. And you have to look at yourself and say, no, wait. I've got the truth. I know the truth. I'm in pursuit of the truth. I'm not the crazy one here. Mm. Okay, so anyway, that's when Jim and Joe asked me to speak a little bit about Hitler's earlier years and the Weimar Republic. It is such an amazing time, the run-up to what became one of the most amazing experiments, if you will, probably in all time, of any country, of National Socialist Germany. Go ahead, Jim.
Now let's just... maybe just kind of review just a point or two from last week. We always have to understand the condition of Germany before, yes, to get it to where it became. So, and a lot of people, yeah, just, they don't understand it. The only thing they understand is Hitler hated the Jews and he wanted to kill the Jews. But they don't understand there was a lot of things that happened there that got Hitler upset with the Jews because of what they were doing. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that. What was going on in Germany that really kind of probably really irked Hitler and the whole movement?
Of course, Hitler was born in Austria, and he was when he decided to be, actually his skill was in art and architecture. He really had an ability. I have a book. Unfortunately, it's in German, and I don't read fluent German, but it is a book of his paintings that he actually did. And there are others who have reviewed his paintings and said, I cannot believe that they would not accept him into the school, and they did not. He saw in Vienna the overwhelming control of the Jews in the Jewish bankers there, and Vienna was, they considered, a hotspot for anti-Semitism. Yeah, well, that's convenient, without having to look into why that would be the case. Lady Michelle Renouf, David Irving say at some point, if the Jews have been kicked out of every decent society, we need to ask why, not, oh, well, poor babies. So why? Okay, so he began to see how they worked, and he made his way to Munich, which occurred about the time of World War One. You think, well, what does World War One have to do with it? It's huge. World War One has enormous amounts to do with it. He received 4 medals during that time. He was not a shirker. He was an absolute, they would probably wish they had thousands just like him, a fanatical soldier. And when the war was over, that was one thing. Germany did not start the war. The Archduke of Ferdinand was assassinated. We got Serbia. We've got Austria-Hungary. At the end of World War One, Germany was saddled with every single blame for every single problem and every single financial responsibility that occurred in World War One. And that was summed up in what became the Versailles Treaty, what they would be required to pay in reparations. I mean, it just went on and on and on. During that period of time, France decided, the French leader decided that Germany wasn't paying fast enough. So they confiscated essentially Alsace-Lorraine. And so Germany was being carved up. In addition to having all their gold taken as reparations for their being blamed for World War One, Hitler had been wounded during the war, but he came out of it, and he was appalled the putsch and everything. He thought that the National Socialists could be the answer for it. The communists were absolutely out of control. They and truly, Germany looked like it was going to turn, that it was going to be subdued by the communists. The communist activists had targeted Germany. They had no idea that Russia was going to turn like it did. That was almost like, oh, well, we didn't see that one coming. And so they, you know, of course, a lot of us know what happened in Russia. The Bolsheviks came into power. They annihilated the Tsar's family, and then it was one blood purge after another. Lenin to Stalin, and Stalin was the absolute brute of the whole thing. Okay, during this time, Hitler was trying to find his way. He found that he could speak, and he could speak well, and he could speak to the hearts of German people. Yet the communists were, they had outnumbered them. The National Socialists, which is a fledgling party, was just getting started. Okay, so they were trying, they attempted a coup, and Hitler was arrested. He had absolute standing ovation during his court appearance, was put in Landsberg prison, wrote Mein Kampf, eventually got out and decided he was going to attempt to achieve the power that he needed to become the leader by legal means. Berlin had absolutely sunk into one of the most despicable cities, as I understand, next to Shanghai, of the world. They were the place where homosexuals came. They had 100,000 prostitutes, 250,000 communist members. When Hitler sent Goebbels to Berlin, you know, we've got to raise, you know, support and expand the membership, there were 200 and National Socialists, 250,000 communists. Needless to say, they were slightly outnumbered. And yeah. Hitler hated, and he wouldn't even, it's like he wouldn't even go to Berlin. He had to send Goebbels. And it just outraged him what was going on there, the pornography, the abuse, and he said, you have to, and he hated the Democratic political parties. They offered no solution to millions of Americans, to millions of, right, well, actually, that was kind of a slip, wasn't it? The only hope was Adolf Hitler. He said, you've been to the marketplace. Do you know how much it costs for a loaf of bread these days? 500,000 marks. 500,000 marks. The wheelbarrows aren't big enough to carry the money in. He's afraid I'll stir things up. You tell Commissar Carl this is not a time for silence. And so the communists were essentially in charge, and people were in absolute poverty. The YouTube, The Greatest Story Never Told, had a huge portion at the end of it dealing with the corruption and the decadence of Berlin. So there are various presidential elections.
Tell us how the Jews played into this, because a lot of people don't
understand. Oh my gosh, that was huge this time. They were buying up property. They had infiltrated and were controlling through the banks. Usury was out of control. They were making a killing off of this. The true parasites of a host is they come in when the host is the weakest. This is absolutely confirmed everything that Hitler knew, and he needed to find a way to bring Germany out from under the Jewish bankers. Their support of the pornography industry, everything vile and despicable they were involved in. And he saw this. He saw this, all this that came out in Berlin. And Berlin was the epicenter of the most hideous. I mentioned before Marlene Dietrich. Yeah, Marlene Dietrich, great star and all that. Yeah, bisexual. Bertolt Brecht and his boyfriend or whatever came to Berlin because it was bugger's paradise. This was the focal point, the magnet for all the putrid parts of Europe. They left all the other places and came to Berlin, and Hitler knew it. So the presidential election in 1925, where Paul von Hindenburg was running, the Nazi Party gained 3 seats. It's a representational government that if you have an election and you have a substantial or amount, minimum amount, you get a certain amount of seats. So the National Socialist Party got 3 seats. And then 1929, they got 107 seats. And 1930, looks like it was the biggest party in the Reichstag at that point. In 1933, it said Hitler despises his coalition partners, von Papen, Hugenberg. He quickly outmaneuvers them and establishes his own dictatorship. But that was while Hindenburg was in office. When Hindenburg died, then he was able to rally his forces and become what he needed to be to essentially salvage Germany. What happened, and this is just, I would have loved to see it, this had been worth paying for, when he became Chancellor and then Führer eventually, the vermin fled. Marlene Dietrich, the Jewish bankers, the politicians, anybody of means, the homosexuals, the poets, all of them fled. They boarded a ship and headed out of town. They got to get out of Dodge. And oh my gosh, guess where they came? That was a boat I would have liked to have turned away. So anyway,
that's a boat you would like to sink.
Okay, yeah. Where are the Russians when we need them, right?
Yeah.
They're sinking. Yes, of course. I was just thinking with the Wilhelm Gustav, they shot refugees and German citizens and killed over 9,000 people. Where were they when this boat was crossing? Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that Hitler did give the Jews an opportunity to leave at that time. They had free rein to leave, and most of them did leave. The ones with the money. They left with all their wares and all their things and went wherever they had to go. Jews obviously stayed. The ones that stayed. But Hitler still, his whole purpose with them, again, people don't understand this. It was not to kill them, but it was he wanted them out of there. But if they didn't all go, then he had to contain them, because most of them were seditionists and against the German party anyway. So that brings us back to 1933. Maybe you can talk about what the Jews did to precipitate all this we're playing chess here now. So in other words, the Jews made a move on Hitler. What people don't understand, who made the first move? Go ahead.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because of his purported stance, they quote unquote feared, which I think is somebody who is always prepared to be a victim. But Hitler had not made a move on them. And so the Jewish leadership declared, okay, this is during the Great Depression. Hitler had just come to power. He hadn't had a chance to attempt to institute his policies to rescue. Germany was really going down for the third count economically. The Jewish leadership issued an international boycott on all German goods. It's absolutely known. In 1933, in March, Hitler came to power in January, and 2 months later, a very devastating effect. Why? Because it might curry favor with other nations. And so he had to face this. Well, if he had any questions about the fifth column that was in his country, he had it quickly removed by this statement. I mean, it hit all the papers everywhere, worldwide, boycott on German products. And no doubt there were some that followed through on it. Depends on where the power was that would apply this kind of sanction against Germany. I contend that every country has their Jewish fifth column that when called upon, they will kick in. And the government will then do their abeyance, bow three times or whatever, hit whatever wailing wall, and then do what they're told. However, Hitler apparently rode this wave. And as a result, I understand in 2 years, despite this, everybody was back to work. 2 years. Mm-hmm. The rest of the world failed to do this. Great Depression. Yeah, we can't. People jumping out of buildings and stuff because their life savings has been destroyed. And Hitler puts 9 million German people back to work.
Mm-hmm. And the Jews try to shipwreck it. I mean, that's what they try to do. And that's
was the point.
Right.
They couldn't.
Right. And so that was their attempt in 1933. Again, right before the war even got cooking there, in 1933, they tried to shipwreck him. They couldn't shipwreck him. Hitler, you know, he raised up and kept going. And, we can go from there. That's all.
Yeah, okay, now he's off and running. The Jews were unsuccessful. The migration efforts that you're talking about is a transfer agreement that I believe began not too long after that. What he was doing was a very conciliatory effort to allow Jews to leave. Unfortunately, and I think if he were to look at a little bit ahead in this or see what we see, he was sending them to Palestine. And 900,000 of them, with their wealth intact in the transfer agreement, were allowed to leave Germany. They wanted to. And he would have continued this, except for the war. In 1939, he had to stop it. And so he, again, was not allowed to do that. But all the way up to 1939, he wasn't collecting Jews to destroy them. He was seriously, the policy of the National Socialists was not to destroy the Jews. It was to get them out of the Reich. And they seemed to be agreeable to this. The Zionists in charge were on very good terms with the National Socialists because this also aided their aims in creating a whatever ethereal homeland they thought they were entitled to. And I think that eventually, if this had all worked out, that Hitler would have had to deal with the on behalf of the Palestinians and what happened with them. But okay, this is what was happening: he was sending them to Palestine. And it was creating this possibility for a homeland for them. He didn't care. Get them out of the Reich. That's all he cared about. That was always all he cared about. He did not want to spend any more than he had to deal with it. And I truly understand. He was able to bring the German economy. He was able to, he did eliminate all rights. Okay, and talking about this earlier, freedom of speech, freedom of press, and so on, all abolished. But essentially, what had it gotten them up to this time? If they had all these things, how was it helping Berlin in the absolute decadence and the destitution that they were in, and overrun by communists and Jews who were using them? And they couldn't even buy bread without taking their money that they would get from a job at the beginning of the day. At the end of the day, they couldn't afford the bread. So they'd have to hurry and go. So what were their quote-unquote Bill of Rights worth to them? They saw, they were willing, and I've heard witnesses say, we're willing to give it up. We need to have a solution. It hasn't done us any good. So they gave it up. Hitler, basically, I'm not a union person by any means. I'm a right to work person, but he got rid of the unions, yay. And so people were there working because they wanted to. Who needed to have the hassle of union bosses telling me when I can and when I can't work? I want to work. The country's impoverished. I want to work. And 9 million Germans were back to work in between 2 to 5 years. He created the minimum wage. He created overtime. People don't even realize this. And so he made a way to get, and also somehow, and a number of people have speculated how he did this, to not have to deal with the Jewish bankers. Usury was wrong. I mean, Goebbels was strong against it. Hitler was strong. They were not prepared to pay interest on any loans, and he didn't feel Germans should even have loans. It shouldn't be so bad that they had to do that. So he did an end run around the Jewish bankers. I have a feeling that was a reason why they came after him with everything they had. Bad precedent. You cannot have a nation going rogue on you and be a bad example to the other nations.
All right, now, we talked about this today, because a lot of people are going to come back and say, well, you know, Hitler wasn't that good. He took away everybody's rights. So what would you say about
that? Absolutely. Again, as I said, I've heard some witnesses or, you know, some German people talking about that. What do we care about rights? Well, he was able to return. They were not able, essentially, to oppose the government. Who would want to? If you got back to work, you know, everything's, you know, you're the only country in the world that's being survived. Who cares? Freedom of the press, well, you know, you talk about the Reich, you talk about your job. I'm not sure that dissidence has a place in the Third Reich. And if it does, I don't know why. You are a dissident because the system isn't working. If it's working, why complain about it? I have no problem with it. In fact, I'd sign my name on the top of the list. I'll give up my rights to have a leader like that. Where do I sign?
Right. Yeah, I know. People don't get it. They don't get it. All right, so continue on getting us into the, you know, we're into the 30s. You know, so go ahead, keep going with this. You know, we're getting through it. This is a good amount.
Okay, yeah, lots. Lots happened. He eliminated crushing unemployment that Germany suffered. Millions encountered new confidence. They had welfare that they needed. They had the help that they needed and expected from a government who took away their rights. Yeah, you can have mine. It may not be so if the government goes crazy and I no longer can express my opinion, it didn't happen. Okay, so interestingly also, Hitler was an environmentalist and a wildlife person. He really liked the outdoors. And he tried to encourage people to enjoy it too. Crime was virtually eliminated. You could walk in Berlin on the street safely. Can you imagine any city? How about Detroit? Crime eliminated.
Yeah. Well, of course they're gonna say, well, I mean, the reason is because if you did anything, they'd just shoot you.
Oh well, that's not true. You might go to one of the camps in Germany for criminals, and as we talked earlier, there were 55,000, the 30, 55,000 criminals in the various camps in Germany. And these are camps to house, as it were, criminals. It just turned out a lot of them were communists, and most of them were Jews. There were actually 3,000 Jews among the 55,000 who were imprisoned, not because they were Jews. Okay, how about because, they actually may have committed a crime? And being a communist in National Socialism, you know, I applaud that. If having I have my rights allows the communists to run amok, like what happened in Berlin, cut them off. You know, that's fine with me. So anyway, so here we are in the throes of the success of the National Socialists. One of the things that started happening, aside from the massive amount of parades and such, that Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl had created, they call it a propaganda film. A lot of marching, a lot of music, a lot of speeches. Propaganda to Goebbels at the time meant conveying of truth. Today it means lying through your teeth so you can get elected. Very different method. And propaganda at that time also was to encourage the people who had put their trust in them in the first place. I am going to the Nuremberg rallies, annual celebration of National Socialism. Albert Speer was an architect, and yet he could put on the most amazing, quote-unquote, parties, searchlights, and they called it a cathedral of lights, where they would be positioned around the Nuremberg Stadium. And they're a very, very emotional experience. People would say, people in the Hitler Youth, people would say, you know, I dared not look at the person next to me because they could see me crying. It was just so moving. Here these people have come from abject poverty and degradation to something, to maybe even the world power at a time when everybody else was trying to find bread. So in the mid-30s were the halcyon years of Hitler's Germany. He was at peace, prosperity was restored, and national pride recovered. Who wouldn't want that? You know, if you're saying, well, but I don't have my right to express. What are you going to express? There's nothing wrong happening. Everything right is happening. Isn't that why we need our ability to express ourselves? It's because our government has screwed up and we need to talk about it?
Right.
But it's not doing this. British Prime Minister David Lloyd George came to visit Hitler secretly. Hitler ran down the stairs to warmly greet him at the Berghof, and the things that were said about Hitler, even Churchill, people were trying to emulate what was going on in Germany. The reason why, another thing that happened, the Anschluss, the joining of Austria with Germany, because they saw how successful Germany, well, they wanted to be a part of it. When the German troops entered Austria, the people were throwing flowers at them. That's why it was called Blumenkrieg. It was an amazing show of solidarity in this. They knew what they were getting. They wanted what they were getting, and other people did too.
Why do you think? Why do you think that Churchill turned against Hitler so vehemently? He just, you know, why don't you? Can you talk about that a little bit? What do you think?
I can tell you. Of course, I've read that he did a complete flip, where he was praising Hitler at one point, to the other point where he says we have to destroy the German people. I have a very good idea, and I think it has a lot to do with Hitler defying the Jewish bankers. Now, pressure has come to bear on Churchill. Hitler has made repeated comments over and over again, and he feels that the British people and he are a brotherhood, that, you know, eventually, you know, they would, because of the British Empire, would rule the world. Now, Hitler did not have aspirations for conquest outside of the European sector, not at all. He wanted to secure Germany. But and Churchill no doubt wanted to keep the empire, which was extremely volatile at this point. And he, you know, Hitler could have probably been an asset to that. No, I think he was. It was made very clear to him that he cannot have sympathetic feelings toward Hitler. He has got to to plan on the destruction, not only of Hitler, but of the German people. We cannot have this kind of...
because they were too good. I mean, it was too good.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. They were too good. People have said, oh, well, you know, the reason why Hitler was taken down because he was too bad. No, 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 no. He had it. He was absolutely on the road to becoming what could have been a one-world government through him. And it was absolutely happening. It may not have been in the timetable that the Lord might have had, but he was on the right track. The people loved him. Oh, and go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead. I'll chip in a second. Go ahead.
Okay, one last thing. The Russians, the Soviets, I like to say Russians because they're different now. The Soviets had to make people attend their mass gatherings, at the point of a gun. You will go out there and or a certain sort of extortion at work, you lose your job, or, you know, off to the gulag you go. In Germany, that was not the case. People, you know, I would be, oh my God, not another parade. But when it was all told, when they attended, they were glad they were there. And there was, it was very much a voluntary thing. And you see the enormity of the amount of people. The population came out there. This was not trumped up. This was heartfelt. And this was true gratitude, knowing where they came and knowing where they were.
Now, what I saw with Churchill, because obviously he had the Jewish influence behind him, saying, you know, we want you to stop this madman. But he couldn't do it by himself. Churchill could not do it. England couldn't do it by themselves. So what do they have? What do you think? You know, what do you think happened there? Right?
Oh, yoo-hoo! Yeah. Okay. There was. We'd have to actually get into the war itself, because what had happened through. You have to fast forward to 39. Is that bypasses a little conflagration between a couple of generals and, you know, Hitler making himself commander in chief, and which was probably a really good idea, and subduing the military and getting rid of the SA and the SS, you know, coming into power. Okay, that happening. Then we have Kristallnacht, which was an actual German outrage at an official being murdered by a Jewish terrorist. And that the people reacted, and Goebbels wanted it stopped because it was affecting the transfer agreement things with the Zionists, and so anyway, the Kristallnacht, where they were breaking windows in Jewish businesses. Okay, that's 38. In case, and then also the annexation of Czechoslovakia, and then 39. Over 50,000 Polish, not 50,000, 50,000 Germans had been killed in Poland. Hitler was very aware of not only discrimination, but ethnic cleansing that the Polish were doing against Germans who were living in their borders. He did not want it to cause a world war. He was going to take care of it himself. And he made overtures to England and possibly to the worthless French, that they, all he wanted to do was to rescue the Germans that were there, to exact justice, and that would be it. But the English maintained that if he did invade Poland, that would start a war because of their so-called alliance. He kept sending, again, more overtures of peace and don't do this. You and I are, we're brothers with you. You know, we have no ill will against you. The French, it's another matter. We'll take care of that. No, that's my input. We don't want this to happen because we will take care of it ourselves. 50,000 Germans killed is not a small amount,
right,
by any means. And then there are the ones that were tortured, the ones that were persecuted, the ones, and so it's just 50,000 are quote unquote only the dead. And so Hitler decided he had to do it. He had to take charge, and he blitzed the Polish, and of course the English came in. Now, problem is, England couldn't handle it by themselves. In fact, Hitler could have took England and France and what other little subsidiary, so-called worthless allies that might oppose him. He could take care of it. Okay, well, enter in 1939, 1940, 1941. Okay. What are we going to do? Oh, dear, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Crying in our beer. Franklin, I need some help. Got to get you in this war. Well, in the meantime, Franklin Roosevelt had broken the Lend-Lease Agreement by allowing Americans to fight with the British. And so the Americans had enlisted with the British to fight against the Germans. The British had initiated assaults on German cities and against German citizens. Hitler really wanted them to stop. He retaliated in the hopes that Churchill would stop it. He didn't stop it. He also, right before the business with Poland, he had the non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, feeling that if he were aligned with them, that the Allies would not attack. Little did he know with whom he was dealing. Hitler was a little bit trusting, although he did know that they were amassing an assault on the border, as Icebreaker reveals by General Zhukov. Okay, so he was hoping, you know, he had covered himself. Go ahead.
Well, no, but the whole thing is that's, I mean, Churchill had to drag the United States into the war because they couldn't
absolutely
do it by themselves.
Absolutely. And the thing is, though, that Franklin Roosevelt did a horrible deed for us. I've been to Pearl Harbor twice. When I go, I make it my Mecca. I cry. I throw in lays. I'm on the Arizona. It should never have happened that those kids were murdered by our president. How was he murdered? And again, this is a 1940s thing, but it still plays into effect of how, and you know, as you said, Jim, that the United States was drugged into it. We had a treaty with Japan, and over the months prior to Pearl Harbor, proceeded to terminate the oil shipments. Just almost 5 months before Pearl Harbor, everything that we had with Japan, we were strangling them. They had basically, and that came from also from England, because Japan had invaded China, I believe Indonesia, and some of those were British territories. And so, you know, old Churchill calls old Roosevelt up on the phone and say, by the way, we need you to do something so we can stop this. We're losing our empire. Well, that ship had sailed, essentially. And so by the time that the Japanese decided to do a preemptive strike on Pearl Harbor, they had basically been, like, starved to death. They had been strangled of their oil supplies. They had been provoked. It's like in football. It's wrong to cross over sides, but it is equally wrong to draw the other one off sides. And that's right. What Roosevelt did with right. the Japanese, the Imperial Japanese army and so on, is to draw them off sides and give it a pretense, because Japan was allied with Hitler and Mussolini, and if you're at war with one, you're war with all. So, bang, bang, boom, we have Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt has his war, oh, who cares that, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 Americans were killed, again, like 9/11, you know, big deal, we got our war, and then Roosevelt was, you know, he's also got the 99% non-combatant type of Americans wanted to stay out of it. A lot of German and Italian individuals in the United States that don't have anything to do with it. It's not our war. It is clearly a European war. Well, that he was able to bypass that by the outrageous propaganda. In this case, it was lies. And to get the U.S. to back and further extend Lend-Lease to Churchill. Now we're in the war. He gets the full magnitude of the U.S. Manufacturing and military force. And yet, it still took a long time to grind it into gear. Now the United States has a two-front war.
Right.
Yay! That's what we always wanted.
Right. Now, we don't want to forget also, too, but in the midst of all this, Hitler was still trying to negotiate a peace.
Yeah.
And he ends up sending, Hess, I guess that's
Hess.
The name, Hess over
yes.
to
Rudolf Hess.
England. He went to Scotland, actually. He ended up crashing the plane or landing the plane in Scotland. And Hitler didn't, as far as I understand, he didn't know what was going on, right? As far as I understand. Did Did he
has took it upon himself, I think. I think that's how it goes.
Yeah. So anyway, so Hess gets captured, and you know, you think they're going to bring him to Churchill and say, "Hey, listen, we can end all this right now." But what do they do? They put him in prison. Jeez.
Yes. So silence him, and actually, they block his appeal, and it almost looks like he was, I wouldn't say defecting, but it looks like he was doing something behind Hitler's back. And I think Hitler had the confidence in him. Now, the cliche movies will say, you know, have Hitler pounding on the desk and saying, you know, he betrayed me. But I don't think so. I think he knew Hess, and I think he knew what he was doing. So, no, they did not want that. And you have to understand, truly, if there had been any heart to cooperate, this would have been done in probably the first 50 overtures of peace. But no, that wasn't the interest, and he's been spurred on. Probably the threat was, if you do not go after this quote-unquote, as you quote it, madman in Germany, we will take your empire. Well, they lost their empire anyway.
Let's talk about now the next thing that would happen here. I think it was 1939. The Jews sided with England in regards to the war. And again, people have to understand that, because you know, they think, you know, Hitler had no right to do anything to the Jews. But remember, the Jews sided with Churchill, which made them all the enemy of the state. Right? I mean, that's what happened.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. They became what none of our internees ever declared. The Germans, the Italians, and the Japanese never declared war. Their leadership never declared war against the United States in this context. It was inferred that because the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, that all the Japanese were a fifth column, as were any of the Allies. And there have been places, I've visited places in Louisiana, throughout the country, where Germans and Italians were interned as a result of this. Okay, not a threat, but a perception of it because of their nationality and connection with the homeland, if you will. Okay, so Chaim Weizmann, okay, as declared, sent a letter to Churchill that all the forces, all the support of the Jewish community will be behind Germany's enemies. Well, to me, that's, you know, that's a declaration of war of a people against it. Well, what's Hitler supposed to do? Oh, well, he didn't mean it. No, that means that they had a fifth column of a substantial amount that were still left in Germany, I believe maybe 4.5 million in the Reich, who could be potential threats, and that is not using it lightly. They were absolutely hell-bent. I'm sure there were a number of them that just kind of rolled their eyes and, oh, I can't believe he did this to us. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's true. But you don't know who it's going to be. And after Germany had their experience later on with partisans, everyone becomes a suspect. So what they had to do is intern them. And it wasn't meant, and that, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in the next broadcast, what the actual rounding up of Jews means. It was not, and the bottom line of it was not meant for extermination. What would Germany on a two-front war want to do with their resources to reduce 4.5-ish Jews? It would not be using gasoline to destroy them and all the other weirdest kind of scenarios. My idea would be, being part German, but mostly the Germans found an efficient way of dealing with their loose cannon population by shipping them to a place near industrial centers where they could help with the war effort. And even in the disgustingly horrible Schindler's List, he actually verified, by virtue of the fact that he attempted to sabotage instruments of German war, that they were actually in an industrial center for the war effort, that wasn't extermination. So anyway, yeah, you have to contain your enemy. If you are in a full-out war on two fronts, and you've got a fifth column that could destroy you from within, you've seen what they did in the Weimar Republic. You've seen how the tentacles snake through and control and attempt to usurp you. What more would it be if they had an actual access? Can you imagine 4.5 million partisans in Germany itself? They had enough trouble when they had to go to the Soviet Union. So, yeah, lock them up. That's what I'd say. And, you know, however it works, a lot of them were in Germany. Most of them were shipped to Poland. Why? Because that's where the ammunition factories were.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, they have to make the worst case scenario, so they have to make it look like he was trying to kill them all.
Well, that worst case.
Work to the Jew is killing them anyway.
Oh my God! I actually have to earn a living. I can't extort it from my neighbor. Oh, that's too bad. Okay, the other thing that's the worst case scenario for them, and they actually consider it. Extermination is migration when they're kicked out of their country. They consider that extermination, so they can weave and dodge and a whole story on that. But no, I think that everything that we are told about what Germany did, the Allies did, and so they weave that in, incorporate that into this mega story, and the Jews say, "Yeehaw!" They're not stupid, and so we have a way of extorting the Western powers. One thing that was asked, I think Lady Michelle Renouf had mentioned this in one of her talks, that they were asked if they could rescue every single Jew out of the Reich, every single Jew, and transport them somewhere else. Would they do that versus killing half of them and use that as a pretense to extort money from their host and creating a homeland and keep the money flowing in? Well, guess what they picked? I'm talking about the hardened Zionists. They said, oh, well, heck, you know, that'd be no question. We'd gladly give up half of the population to get the kind of money that we want coming in. So, you know, talk about anti-Semites.
Right. Well, the Zionists, they sold their own people out. They didn't care. You know?
Oh, and they will also stringently discipline them for veering off the path, if you will.
Yeah.
So as to be an example to others of what not to do. I mean, they make the mafia look like Granny's Tea Party.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, I tell people today that the Jews, you know, the normal mom and pop Jews, they don't understand how they're being manipulated by the upper level Zionist Jews. They don't get it. They're just pawns.
Yes.
They're just pawns on the chessboard, and they're just being pushed along, and they're going along with it, and they don't understand why, you know, why does everybody hate us? Well, you know, why? Well,
let me count the ways. We don't have that kind of time. But one of the things, why does everybody hate us, really? Is it that big a mystery? I mean, my God, we've been telling them for 2,000 years, okay, the whole original conspiracy thing notwithstanding. I'd like to mention that there are an enormous amount of people who are coming to understand these things. What happens is, and this is something, a quote that I've been saying a lot more lately, when you remove the lies about someone, what you have left is what they have done and who they are. When you remove the lies about Adolf Hitler, it's just amazing what is there. Leon DeGrill has published a book. I don't know if he's still alive. At least somebody in his name has published a book called Hitler Democrat. And Ingrid Rimlin, actually she's now Ingrid Zundel, has been providing a number of insights that, you know, a couple of paragraphs from him, maybe a page every day from this book. And it's one that I really, really, really want to get. Because it has thoughts to remember. One paragraph I'd like to mention, it says, Hitler was self-taught and made no attempt to hide the fact the smug conceit of intellectuals, their shiny ideas packaged like so many flashlight batteries, irritated him at times. His own knowledge he had acquired through selective and unremitting study, and he knew far more than thousands of diploma-decorated academics. That's just the beginning. You know, he was a vacuum cleaner of information. He absolutely sucked up everything that he read, and he read everything, financial, political, everything
they
of the
said,
time.
They said he read a book a day.
Oh, wow. I would not be surprised.
Well, that article I was reading that you sent me there, the big long article, well, that was it. Wasn't that the article about the grill? It said he read a book a day.
The Enigma of Hitler. That was another one. That was an amazing one. It would be almost worth a show to do Leon DeGrille's perception of Adolf Hitler. I know, right?
that was phenomenal. I mean, if you know, like I was talking to you about, if people ever read that, they would think that Hitler was the savior. You know.
That would be a temptation. It's just at the very least, as I said, the lies about him would be swept away.
Yeah.
And then you could do real research. Then you could do real reading. And then you would have the BS detector that would allow you to see what are lies. There are a number of historians that David Irving, I love his take on it. He said, oh, he's a fake. He's a fraud. I love it. I mean, he spares, there are so many of them. He didn't say that about Tolan, but he has said them, no doubt, about, you know, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, whatever his name is. You know, this, all that was bogus. And, you know, all this thing is just merely because they're going into second and third hand information. There needs to be, when there is an appreciation, of course, you know what happens. You start appreciating Hitler, you know, everybody, this voluminous kind of eruption occurs. And this gasping of, how dare you think that this individual has any credibility who we have deemed as some sort of horrible, demonic mass murderer. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, like that picture you have on that you use about Donald Sutherland and the invasion of the body snatchers, you know, pointing at somebody who is human and not one of the pod people. And so that's just what it is. All of a sudden, somebody that you love and care about takes on the form of this demon-possessed, out-of-control kind of you-need-to-die kind of person. It's just unbelievable. But, you know, that, well, dare I think that sweeping away the lies about someone might reveal who they really are. Wow, what a novel idea, and I would like that to be about me if there are lies, and you too, and so that would be wonderful. Well, how does that happen? Well, you be prepared to let it go, and we the people who are holding on to these lies are just not prepared to let it go.
Right. Yeah,
I can't believe all the stuff he'd read.
Yeah. Well,
I'm looking at it. I mean, there are two paragraphs of people that he's read. I wouldn't read half of these people, but he read all of them. Goethe, Shakespeare, Renan, Gobineau, Chamberlain, Sorel, Calvin, Jesus, Luther, you know, all of Aristotle, Plato. My gosh, that makes my head hurt. So,
yeah. Wow.
You've got 2 minutes.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, you know, we covered quite a bit. I mean, hopefully, you know, if anybody's listening to this, well, they listen to it on the archive, they can understand how Hitler was misaligned. Oh, a minute and a half. But, they, you know, they could definitely see there's a big issue here. And, you know, it's going to be hard for the majority of people to see through the lies, but, you know, one show at a time, that's all you can do. One person at a time, Facebook,
that's right,
and all the links at a time. We're getting more people to see it. I mean, I'm noticing more videos on YouTube. You know, other people are putting stuff up. They're seeing it. It's getting there. Getting there little by little. So that's kind of cool. You know, I'm happy about that. Well, look at. I think we're gonna have to wind down here. But well, you did good, Diane. You covered a lot of points. You know. Next time we talk, you know, we'll get into another facet. If you want to do something on Leon, that fellow there, that could be fine too. you know, you could deal with that.
We might have to before we go into the dark times, because when we talk about the 1940s, we really have to talk about all the bad stuff. And it is bad. It is very bad, especially when I know that if it hadn't been for Roosevelt's Lend-Lease, the war would have been over in 1941. It would have been it. And there probably wouldn't have been a Pearl Harbor.
Right, right. I hear you. All right, I think we only got a couple seconds left here. 10 seconds left. All right, this is going to, you know, I want to just thank everybody for listening. Diane, thank you very much. I'll talk
You're
to
welcome.
You in a little bit. And I'm going to let this run out, and I don't know how I'm going to close it down because I don't have anything to close it down with. But I'm going to see what I can do here when this ends. All right, everyone, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next week. All right, let me see if I can do that.
Bye-bye.